Welcome to Planetary Spirit, coming to you on ETIN, Emerson College's Talk and Information Network. My name is Jeff Ferranini, and I invite you on an exploration of spirituality. And my guest today is Chris Lemig, who is a writer and a gay man who talks about his coming out, his addiction, and his finding Buddha, all in his newly published book entitled The Narrow Way. Now, let me tell you a little bit about him. He says, even at 12 years old, Chris Lemig knows he's gay. He just doesn't want to believe it. Spurred on by intolerance, ignorance, and fear, he takes his first steps into the closet, and so begins 23 years of drinking, drugs, and attempted suicides. It's only after he wakes up one morning, beaten and still bleeding from a hate crime, that he finally finds the courage to come out and make a change. Renewed and refreshed, he finds sanity and healing in the teachings of Tibetan Buddhism, and without looking back, sets off on an inspired pilgrimage to India and Nepal. And his website is www.thenarrowwaybook.com. That's TheNarrowWayBook.com. So it is indeed a pleasure to welcome today to Planetary Spirit, Chris Lemig. Hey, Chris, how are you?
Good, good. Thank you, Jeff, for having me. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to have you here. And what a powerful book you've written. And I want to get into that. But I first thought I would start off just a little bit off the beaten path here with a poem.
Okay.
And I think you're probably going to relate to this poem.
Okay.
It's called Recognition. Hmm. Spirit, where are you leading me? To what unknown destination am I slowly being pulled towards? Is the heart of me that does the pulling, moving me in various ways to where I long to be? Why do I hesitate at every tug to follow? My steps seem to pull away from inner urgings, carrying me further into darkness and confusion. Must I meet something there to wrestle with? Shall I claim victory after fighting my demons, or will I wander down aimless paths forever? O Great Spirit, I am calling for you to manifest now in my life. Show me my purpose, passion, power, and vision, pointing me towards my greater reason to be. To celebrate in purest joy the miracle of me. That I am here and now alive at this time in the history of our planet, have come to this earth on a mission to remember all I came to be. Great Spirit, you live inside of me. Give me courage to set you free. In the words of Mahatma Gandhi, be the change in the world I seek. Within me now, live in me.
Wow. Very profound.
So I think you can sort of relate to that.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're on a journey here, I believe, and the journey that I've been on is not dissimilar to what I think many, many people have gone through. In fact, maybe all of us go through, in that we do go through in our lives a period sometimes of darkness and confusion and uncertainty, knowing kind of at the bottom of our heart that there's something, calling to us, or that there's some other larger purpose that we're supposed to be fulfilling or could be fulfilling. And unfortunately, some people don't ever recognize what that is. Tragically, a lot of people die without ever discovering that. But many, many, many other people do actually discover that, as I've discovered along my journey and found other people along the way who've gone through similar battles with addiction and depression and self-loathing and these sorts of things come out the other end, you know, just as heroically as anyone else. You know, it truly is a heroic act that we're all capable of. So, yeah, and then, you know, once through that, if we can be blessed enough to actually align ourselves with our higher nature or great spirit, as the, you know, say in the poem there, that's just, it's absolutely miraculous and beautiful. Yeah, I can relate to that poem.
Well, I wanted to begin our conversation with something that I don't normally begin with. Normally, I will find in somebody's introduction some little gem that I want to read and share with listeners. But in your case, it's the acknowledgments that really drew my eye.
Ah, okay.
And that's what I want to read.
Okay.
So here's where you say in the acknowledgments, interdependence is one of the most beautiful and profound concepts in all of Buddhism. It tells us that nothing exists separately from anything else. Everything is connected. When we look at a flower in a garden, our normal vision sees a lone object existing almost as if in a vacuum. But when we look a little closer, we see that the causes and conditions that bring that flower into being are inconceivably vast, like a jeweled web that extends into infinite space and time. Its myriad parts, the petals, the stem, the leaves, as well as its color, shape, and scent, all contribute to its unique expression. The flower is also dependent on the sun, the rain, the clean air, the worms, the soil, and not in least, on the gardener who tends to it. It cannot exist without all these things working in concert. Then I want to fast forward over to your... Most people tend to have a poem or some quote or something that they start their book with.
Right.
And yours is in the top is entitled The Narrow Way.
Right.
And the quote is, "You are not alone. There are others on the way, on the same track, travelers from nowhere to nowhere, on their way from nothing to nothing. The track may be narrow and steep and boring and frightening, but everybody walks it. You are not alone, but linked to everything around you." And that's Jan William or Willem van der Wettering.
Yes, yes. Yeah, he's a Dutch author who wrote, he's actually a crime novelist. But also wrote a couple of interesting Buddhist memoirs, one called The Empty Mirror, in which he talks about his first foray into the world of Zen Buddhism by traveling to Japan and spending 6 months in a monastery in Japan and living there, and had quite an experience himself. So I highly recommend that book. So, yeah.
So I'm always surprised when I read somebody's book, as I read yours, Chris.
Yeah.
And I see how invested they are in putting themselves into that book, really kind of pulling back their skin and exposing themselves with a really almost harrowing vulnerability to bring the truth out in the open. So people who really have not been walking in your shoes can get a feel for how it is to be in that skin.
Yeah, I think it's very important, especially in the realm of memoir, to do that. You know, I struggled with a lot of a lot of issues. You know, as I wrote this book, I had, you know, kind of, I think, worked through my own psychology, if you would, you know, by going through therapy and things like that. So I don't feel the book was cathartic in any way, and in a sense, like, oh, I needed to, you know, have it be some, you know, confessional text where, you know, I just needed to get things off my chest. I feel I had done a fairly good job, you know, with a lot of help of, you know, kind of working through that myself. But as I sat down and decided to write the book, I was, you know, looking at other memoirs of how other people have done it in the past, and, you know, just felt through it myself and realized that the only way to do a memoir is with full disclosure. I mean, you know, it's necessary because you have to be truthful and authentic in order to really draw the reader in and to also assure the reader and other people too that, hey, we all go through this stuff, you know. I think that was my main point, was like that I'm no different than anyone else in terms of my fallibility, my weaknesses, my obsessions, my, you know, the difficulties that I faced. You know, I believe, you know, truly that we all experience these things on some level or another. So I think the authenticity is very, very important to make that connection and to also just, you know, validate each and every person's experience as well.
Mm. Now, do you have the book in front of you?
I do, actually.
Okay. Can you turn to page 14?
Sure.
And about midway down, the line that begins, it took you almost 2 hours.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to read that to the end?
Absolutely, absolutely. This is from the chapter called First Love. It took you almost 2 hours to ride your bike all the way from New London. And I spent the whole time staring out the window, waiting for you to roll around that corner. By the time you arrived, I must have looked a terrible mess, pale, sweating, and trembling with fever. You let your bike fall into the fresh-cut grass and walked towards me through the thick air of summer that was filled with the love song of birds and wind and ocean. "Want to look at some dirty magazines?" I blurted. "Sure," you said again, and I thought, this is it. It's really going to happen. So up to my room we climbed with me holding your hand, and I pulled out the stash of Hustlers and Penthouse that I had long ago pilfered from my dad's closet. We lay out on my bed and flipped through the glossy pages together. You sneered a little in disbelief that people's bodies could really do things like that. Your naivete filled me with a surge of confidence, and I was sure that you would do anything I asked. "Do you know how to masturbate?" I finally said in an overture of love. It was a great leap into the unknown, and I waited, afraid to move or even breathe, as the birds and the grass and the ocean and the wind all leaned up close to my window and waited too. "No," you said, with your face twisted in a contortionist act of disgust. "That's a sin." Did my face twist then too? Did you see my watering eyes filling slowly with disappointment and disgrace? We were on stage again, but this time it was me that everyone was laughing at, pointing their fingers and crying, "Pansy, pansy, he's a little pansy," in that sing-song revel that every generation learns anew. My heart broke right then and there. You weren't gay at all. You didn't want to have anything to do with me. And so it was that you stood by me that day as I took my first step into the closet, and it would be years before I saw you again.
You know, in some respects, your book kind of reminds me of that. I think it's a novel by Irving Stone about Michelangelo, and it's called The Agony and the Ecstasy.
Right.
You know, the wanting of a young child to feel love and to be held and comforted and cared for, right, and be sexual with somebody.
Right.
And then to have that thwarted over and over and over again, and being told that who you know yourself to be is not safe to be in the world.
Right, right. It's profoundly confusing, especially to a child, you know, to an adolescent. It was enormously difficult because the messages are so conflicting. Your body is giving you one message, your soul is giving you one message, and those are in concert. You know, you're just like, this is the truth of me, and then the whole of society and family and all of the institutions, all of the media that we get are giving you something that's completely different. And it's saying that, like, that which you feel is so deplorable and unworthy. And so you have these conflicting messages, and they're really, really difficult to reconcile. In fact, almost impossible. Even today, when things are getting a little bit better in this country, it's still very, very difficult to get through this period and come out the other side with a sense of self-worth. You know?
Yeah, and that's why I mean, this book is 182 pages. It's actually quite thin.
Right.
And very easily readable. And it really does take you on a journey inside, this interior journey of what would lead this person to be drinking, binging, drinking, be doing drugs to excess and, you know, doing all this stuff. It's like if you come back to normal life, you know, in your head, what you're really hearing is self-loathing. What you're hearing is your mother, who's now remarried with this man who is very demanding of how things need to be, and there is no safety in your life.
Right, right.
And so the only safety that you can find is this kind of out of control, you know, booze and drugs world, and the people that sort of inhabit that.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah. So that's why I want to kind of paint the scene the way you do to give people an understanding as to there really wasn't a huge choice here.
Right.
You didn't really see any other way. There wasn't a narrow way to be chosen.
Exactly.
There was only, you know, I hate myself, I'm no good, I don't fit in, I'm not the right dot, dot, dot.
Right.
And even the people who are supposed to love me and care for me don't want anything to do with me. If I reveal myself to them, they're going to hate me and be one of the biggest haters in the group that's out there wanting to hate me to begin with.
Right, right. And then, you know, and then I would be alone and completely unwanted and cast aside. And that's terrible. It's a terrible thing to be afraid of, you know, and to believe, whether it's true or not, whether it's true or not.
So if you could turn to page 26.
Sure.
And on 26, if you find the place where you, it starts, I run up the stairs to lock my, okay? And then go back down to there is nothing left to hide,
there is nothing,
which is right above the last beginning paragraph.
Okay, all right.
Okay, could you read that, please?
Sure. I run up the stairs to lock myself in my room, my sanctuary. But when I get to the top and push open the door, the blood drains out of me and into the floor. My bed is overturned. All my dresser drawers have been tossed around and emptied. My locked file cabinet, my treasure chest of adolescent mysteries has been pried open, and all the secret, sacred contents looted. Everything has been found. The cigarettes, the liquor, the pornography, the dildos, the stockings. It's not me, it's not me, it's not me, it's not me. But when I open my eyes again, the mantra hasn't worked and nothing has changed. But then the panic subsides. I take a deep breath. I relax and let go. Now they know. They must know. Now I am transparent and all of my longing is known to the world. There is nothing left to hide.
It's so interesting, you know, even in that dark place, you're still desiring for your mother to accept you.
Right, right.
You know, there's this shred of hope that there's a possibility, and yet, you know, that doesn't seem to come about.
Right, right. Not for many years.
So then, you know, we kind of are jolted or moved back and forth in a timeline. You're on the tarmac. You're heading to India. Now, many years later, you have decided you're going to go on a quest to go to India. Why Buddhism and why India?
I had had some interest in Buddhism for a while, although, oddly enough, I kind of didn't know it. I had stumbled across one night on a meth binge a documentary on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it really kind of moved me, you know. And but I kind of filed it away because it was like in a very dark place at that time, for many years later. And I feel like I just kind of filed it away, and it was in my subconscious, just sitting there brewing, just kind of waiting to be rediscovered at some point. And I remember, like I say, many years later, probably about 10 years later, I was just about to take my first steps on the true path of recovery that I'm still walking at this point. I remember writing in a journal, I was still drinking at the time, but I remember writing, I want to look into Tibetan Buddhism. And I knew that I couldn't do that until I kind of, I actually stopped drinking and stopped using and was a little bit more clear-headed. So I kind of made a pact with myself at that point that, you know, once I took that real step, then I would look into Buddhism. So I did. You know, I didn't know what I was in for. But after I kind of, started going to some AA meetings and getting some therapy and some other help on the path of recovery, I went to a bookstore and picked up a book on Buddhism and took it home in my arms and started reading it, and it really just blew me away. It just resonated with me so clearly. It was just a gong of an enormous bell. And I just knew then that it's like, this is what I've been looking for. This is what I've been missing. And so for me, it was the truth that I'd been seeking. At that point, I wanted to devour as much as I could about Buddhism. So I just kept reading and reading and reading. And then I was just feeling just new and awake and alive like I'd never felt before. And I was like, I want to have an adventure. And I was trying to think of something that I was going to do with my life now that I had all this free time and energy and, you know, financial resources and these sorts of things. And so I finally decided that, you know what, I'm very interested in Buddhism. I want to go to the land of Buddhism, where Buddhism was born, and take a look at it. Again, I was just kind of following my heart here. I didn't really, you know, I wasn't intellectualizing it. I was just like following my intuition, which was the best thing I've ever done with my life. So I had never really done that before. I'd always resisted my intuition. You know? And so it was really a huge leap of faith, all of it, you know, picking up that first book, making the decision to go to India, following through on it, even though I was scared as hell, and then getting there and not turning right back around and getting back on the plane and heading home once I did get there.
I'm also wondering, too, you know, a lot of different religious possibilities and perspectives that you could have looked at and possibly, you know, chosen to wrap your arms around.
Yeah.
Buddhism, as far as I know, doesn't have anything to say about homosexuality.
Right, right. Well, it does and it doesn't. I mean, there's not really strict moral or ethical do's and don'ts in the Buddha Dharma. There are observations of cause and effect of how our actions lead to either happiness or suffering, and that's the main discovery of the Buddha, is that he discovered that, look, we're responsible for our own happiness or suffering. It's caused by our actions. It's caused by how we view things, how we view reality. It's caused by our grasping and our aversion. To the degree in which we do that leads to, you know, our degree of happiness or suffering. And so there's simply like, it's laid out as to like, well, if you're interested in being happy, if you're interested in being free, these are the things that are going to lead you in that direction. Not because we've just said so, but because the Buddha and people who have come after the Buddha have put this plan into action and have actually attained that result. So there's not a whole lot of, you know, this kind of sexuality is good, this thing is bad. There's not a whole lot of judgment like that. I mean, there's some cultural things that do come up about, you know, you know, homosexuality is a non-virtue and things like that, and it's brought up from time to time, but that's usually a cultural thing. And you can kind of just look at it as such and kind of let go of that, but it's not really a big hang-up. So.
Well, I don't think Buddhism really looks real strongly at sexuality, period, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual.
Nope, not really. It doesn't really say a whole lot about it. There's five precepts that you can take as a you know, aspiring Buddhist or a Buddhist practicing Buddhist, and one of them is that I will abstain from sexual misconduct or harmful sexual action, and that's all that is really said. I mean, it's not really expounded upon too much, but basically it just means you're not going to hurt others with sexuality. Mm. You're not going to hurt yourself or others is the main thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that can be interpreted through a cultural lens, or you can take a step back a little bit further and just say, okay, I'm just not going to, you know, if it hurts, don't do it.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Wise words.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. So, Chris, we're going to take a short break now. Will you stay on the line with us?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, great.
Okay.
And you're listening today to Planetary Spirit. This is Jeff Fiorinini, your host, and we're talking with the author, Chris Lemming, who is the author of his book entitled The Narrow Way, A Memoir of Coming Out, Getting Clean, and Finding Buddha. And his website is www.thenarrowwaybook.com. That's TheNarrowWayBook.com. And if you're enjoying this program, other interviews are available on the Planetary Spirit website for listening or downloading. Just go to www.planetary-spirit.com. And so we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back, so stay tuned.
Some say love, it is a river that runs. Some say love, it is a razor that leaves your soul to bleed. Some say love, it is a hunger, an endless aching. Only for the light.
And welcome back to Planetary Spirit. This is Jeff Ferranini, your host, and we're talking today with my guest, Chris Lemmig, who is the author of The Narrow Way, a memoir of coming out, getting clean, and finding Buddha. And his website is www.thenarrowwaybook.com, TheNarrowWayBook.com. Hey, Chris, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. This is great.
You're welcome. And so I want to set up the next piece. So can you go to page 37?
Okay.
And in the bottom there, I think it's the bottom paragraph, it says, in my dream.
Right, right.
And then read that till the end. But before you do that, talk to me a little bit about you're now in Dharamsala, India. Made the trip, you've found Buddhism, you've gotten clean from your addiction.
Yeah.
You've had a lot of different changes in your life.
Yeah.
And this is now coming about. And this has really been a dream for you for quite some time.
Yeah.
The idea of getting clean, of getting sober, has really been something that has been on the horizon, but you never 100% sure if you're really ever going to get there.
Right, exactly.
And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's it's a common experience for a lot of addicts. You know, it's like we've been clinging for so long to this way of life, to the even though it's a terrible, terrible way of life, it's also strangely comforting. We don't know anything else. So, so at that point in my life, I was had been trying to get on the road to recovery for a couple of years. At that point, you know, I had made some overtures and made some initial attempts, but it never really took. And the main reason why it didn't take for me anyway was my the fact that I hadn't yet admitted to myself that I was gay, and that that I needed to come out to myself as much as I needed to come out to people I cared about. So once I was able to do that, then the possibility for sobriety was really there, because then I began to be able to uncover the causes for my addictions, for the reasons why I didn't love myself. And through, a process of therapy and self-exploration, I was able to kind of get to that point where it was like, wait a minute, I'm worth happiness. I'm worthy of being happy, of being sober, of being clear-headed, of being, of having a meaningful life, you know? So it was like a night and day change. Once I kind of got on that road, it took me about a year to get to India, and you know, all the way I'd been, you know, studying and preparing and kind of moving closer and closer to this idea of, yes, I'm going to identify now not only as a gay man, but as a Buddhist. You know, I'm okay with that, because I felt okay enough with myself to be able to, you know, take on a label for a minute. And so then I found myself in India, and then where this chapter is, I'm at a retreat, a Buddhist retreat in India, in Dharamsala, in McLeod Ganj.
So let me take it from there, because I want to read a few passages before you read the one that I've asked you to.
Sure.
Okay, so you're going to this retreat center called Toshita.
Right.
You have to pass the thousand monkeys
that are
going to rip you arm from limb.
Right, exactly.
And then you get to the top and you're in paradise.
Yeah.
And so then they're starting registration, and you're kind of just in this swarm of people, about 40 or 50 people who aren't talking really to one another. You're all kind of woozy from just the experience of being there where you are.
Right.
And you hear, we're going to begin the registration now, a young Swiss woman calls out over the tops of our heads. I tense and stiffen, wait and worry. Is my name really on that list? I may be clean-headed and sober now, but the old me, the me that doesn't believe in myself, is still there, still fighting to run the show. Christopher Lemmig, I laugh out loud. Of course, I was the first to sign up months before any of the others. So now I head to the dining hall. It has all been set up like an assembly line. Then there are rules and regulations to agree to, rooms to be assigned, maps to look over. Does that watch have an alarm? The young man behind the last table asks. I squint at his name tag. John, it says. I hold up the fancy watch like a game show host. John, this thing will scramble eggs if I ask it to. Good. You can be the morning gong ringer then. Meet me outside the front of the Gompa in an hour, and I'll show you what to do. The gong ringer. It sounds so important, so official. The shame I felt only a moment ago is swept away by the pride that swells over its banks, and I polish my knuckles on my chest as I follow the little map up the hill to my room. Only a year ago, I was smoking cigarettes and drinking myself half to death, but now I am here in India, and I am already the gong ringer.
Yes, the mind is a funny thing. The ego is a funny thing. Up and down all the time.
Yeah. So now if you would read that passage that I asked you to.
Sure, absolutely. In my dream, a figure in robes is walking along a winding stone path through the mists and the trees. It is a still moment, a perfect moment, and I think that the sun has just stretched his arms up over the unseen horizon. Out of this peace and silence, I can hear the ringing of a great bell. It fills all of space, and it is pure and high and clear. What a wonderful way to wake up, I think, as the figure in robes comes closer. The bell rings again, louder this time. I roll over out of sleep and pick up my watch. 6:06, it reads. Oh shit, I cry as I snap up out of bed, knocking my head on the shelf above. The stone Buddha tumbles down into my lap, but I do not see that he is smiling at me all the while. I put him back up on the shelf, leap out of my sleeping bag, and in one fluid motion, I am in my shoes and heading for the door. My roommates stir out of their own dreams and try to focus through sleep-filled eyes, but I am already gone out into the mists and the blue light of the real dawn. I run down the slippery moss-covered steps, straining my ears for the next ring of the bell. I come around the corner, and there is John walking up the path towards me. His hair is tousled, and he is still half asleep. Sorry, I say, breaking the silence again. I wince, waiting for some stern word of rebuke, but he doesn't scold me or shush me or slap my wrist. He just hands me the gong and, with a nod and a sleepy smile, walks back down the path. I stand still for a moment and laugh under my breath. It is so quiet up here in these hills. The only noise I can hear is the noise inside my head. But even that fades away as I take the gong and the mallet up to the last spot of the morning's rounds. I stand there on the top of the hill overlooking the gardens and the Gompa. I hold the bell high, swing the mallet. Then I wait and listen as the silence holds the ringing close in her arms, like a mother who has called her one and only child home.
I find that so touching. You are waiting for the storm to come.
Yeah.
And it doesn't.
Right.
And to me, that just says, not only am I home, but this is real.
Right.
You know, this trip to India, this imagining that I'm a Buddhist, this pilgrimage I'm taking, and here is this man who has every right to really give you a good whipping, verbally or physically or whatever.
Right.
And he chooses not.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that like for you?
That moment, it was just beautiful. It was a realization that we are in charge of our emotions, not the other way around. You know, we think that our emotions are in charge. We think that our judgments make up who we are. We think that our opinions and our beliefs and our experiences and our memories, these are all that we are. And yet, we're not that. Those are just adventitious things that come and go, and they come and go out of what? Out of silence, out of stillness, out of calm, out of clarity. And that's our true nature. And that's something that I wasn't, you know, consciously realizing then, but it was definitely in the back of my mind. And it's something that that I'm looking to understand every day now. So it was a very moving experience.
Yeah, I found it very touching, you know, especially everything that you had been through.
Yeah.
And then to, you know, have this affirmation of sorts that is wordless come to you in that way, that really, to me, is the deeper meaning of spirituality.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I think so. I mean, I think you know that, you know, like I say, the silence is kind of a metaphor for the ground of our nature, of our being, of our, you know, the life that we live. We're fundamentally safe if we let ourselves be embraced by that divinity, if you like to call it that, by that mother-like silence.
Yeah, yeah. Now, can you turn to page 98?
Yes.
And on the bottom, I think it's kind of like the beginning of the paragraph, with my face hidden.
Yes.
Okay, and then just read until then I let it go.
Okay, sure.
And can you set this up?
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
Like, where are you? You're 10 days now into the, Tung Shiai or whatever.
Tung Shida,
okay.
Yeah.
And you've been meditating every day intensely.
Right.
And this is towards the end of that.
Right.
10 days.
Right. Exactly, yeah. So this is the end of a 10-day introduction to Buddhism retreat that they do several times a year there at Tushita Retreat Center. And it's a wonderful program of meditation and teachings that kind of lay out, you know, for the curious and also for the practitioner, you know, what is Buddhism? What is it that we're trying to do here? And it kind of takes you through step by step in a very logical way, you know, the steps of the path of Buddhism. So at the end of all of this, there was a ceremony that we were doing. We were offering light to all of the Buddhas, to all of our teachers, to all of you know, the sort of the Buddhist cosmology, and to all beings. We're offering this light, this symbolic light, that may all beings be guided out of suffering. May they all be guided to wisdom, guided to love, guided to an understanding of their true nature. So this is the ceremony that we're doing, or getting ready to do. This is like just after some intense meditation. Yeah, this is towards the end of the retreat here, where I'm just kind of letting go. So with my face hidden there in my arms, I begin to realize that it's okay to feel vulnerable and afraid. It's okay that I spent years hiding the truth about myself. It's okay that I was lonely and angry and a little bit crazy. It's okay that I hurt myself and even the ones I love. It's okay that I made so many mistakes. Right here, right now, all can be acknowledged. All can be forgiven. As I embrace all of these shortcomings, I begin to feel myself let go. The merciless inner critic who used to slash me down to the bone is silenced, and for the first time in years, maybe even for the first time in my whole life, I feel real compassion for myself. Finally, I see the reality of my own suffering, and I am not so afraid of it anymore. I lift my head up, and the sun is still shining warm on my shoulders. I look around and see that there are many sets of glistening eyes looking right back at me. It is a good sight, not a sad one. I know now that all of these people have seen something good and fertile and rich within themselves, and that they too have decided to keep it and till it into the deep soil of their lives. I take a slow, deep breath, the kind that hurts your lungs after a long cry. Then I let it go.
Excuse me. Now, if you turn to page 100, And just read that paragraph, the hairs on my neck.
Sure. The hairs on my neck stand on end, and I shiver. I have never felt such sincerity, such kindness, such pure and good belief in action. After all the talk of enlightenment and liberating countless beings from the suffering of beginningless lives, it all comes down, right here and now, to the real love and compassion that ordinary human beings can have for one another. It doesn't matter if we are Buddhist or Christian or Muslim or Jewish or even no religion at all. We can all make prayers together and wish the best for everyone.
Yeah, powerful, powerful words. So, again, your book kind of flips back and forth in time.
Yeah.
So at some point, you're starting to come out of the rehab. You're losing the need for addiction, and you've
right.
kind of made the choice. I think you're in Colorado at that time, living
right.
with family.
Yeah.
And you're doing the work. So you're going in front of your mirror.
Yeah.
And you're saying, I love you, I love you, I love you,
right.
again and again and again. And
yeah.
at some point, you say, you don't even feel foolish saying it.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so you say, I begin to realize that I am my own best friend.
Right.
But
right.
then you say, but this is only the beginning. There is still one last dragon to slay, snarling and gnashing its teeth right there on the path in front of me. I know I can't go any further unless I face it. So finally, standing on solid ground and trembling only a little, I take the next step.
Yeah.
Can you read from the bottom of 112
sure.
to signs and portents?
Yeah, absolutely. We round the lake at Memorial Park for the third time, and the storm clouds over Pike's Peak are held at bay by the power of our conversation. We have been talking deeply for almost an hour, this after barely speaking for a year. 365 days of carefully orchestrated avoidance, bristling at the sight of one another, walking on eggshells. But now the walls are down. The truth has been freed from its cage, and there is nothing left of me that can be hurt. Mom, I'm gay. There, I have said it. It is done. Droplets of rain begin to fall, welcome cool in the 100-degree heat of July summer. You know, she says, I've never told anyone this. I smiled down at her, my mother, who used to loom before me and terrify me. When you were born, the hospital was out of blue blankets. So you know what they did? They brought you to me wrapped in a pink one. I should have known then. I exhale a little laugh through my nose and smile wider. Signs and portents, I say. Signs and portents.
What a lovely scene. you know, just all this tension, all this angst, all this brooding that, you know, is coming. You're saying you have to slay the dragon.
Right.
And then when you come out with it, she tells you this tender little story.
Yeah.
And it draws the both of you together in a wordless way.
Right.
That just dissipates all of that emotion that was dark and holding you from one another.
Right. Right, exactly. It poisoned our relationship, you know.
Yeah.
And it was. It was that at that moment that even though I had, you know, been out to my father and my brother, and it was becoming general knowledge, I still hadn't, you know, formally come out to her. And it was a symbolic act as well as it was just simply necessary too. But yeah, after that, our relationship completely changed its whole dynamic, and we were able to be, you know, we're to this day very, very close.
So now go to page 125. I hope you don't mind me asking you to read all this.
No, this is fine.
Oh, okay.
Fine. Yeah, sure.
So for this is, I think this is on the last day
all right.
of the teachings with His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
And so you've just been in the courtyard hearing him speak for a number of days.
Right.
And this is kind of something that kind of wells up in you.
Yeah.
And so if you would read for 20 years.
Okay. For 20 years, I took refuge in drugs, in sex, in fleeting moments of relief. I took refuge in my loneliness, in my hopelessness, and my despair. I took refuge in the lies I told myself and in the fiction of myself that I had written down in painstaking detail. But now that fractured self, healed and whole, is finally able to declare something with irrefutable certainty. And so I repeat the words that the Dalai Lama asks us all to recite. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And like that, it is done. Nothing has changed. Everything has changed. I walk back up the hill. I am a Buddhist now. There is a clap of thunder right above me. Huge drops of rain fall from the sky, slapping and stinging my face. Soon the street is a rushing river of flotsam that washes the whole earth clean. Monks in red robes unfurl rainbow umbrellas and dart up the hill, laughing. I blink my eyes once, then twice, but they are still there, and all I can do is stand with open arms as the rain comes pouring down.
Mm. Very nice, very nice. So then while you're in India, you decide to go to the four places that are the most sacred to the Buddhist people.
Right.
And talk a little bit about that. What were the high points for you?
It was quite a pilgrimage. It was quite difficult. I had been what some people call India Light in McLeod Ganj, which was still rather intense, you know, culturally shocking. But going out into this quote unquote the real India was really difficult. You know, I had to do a lot of overland travel on trains and taxis, and you know, deal with all kinds of unimaginable sights and sounds and smells that just completely bowled me over at times. But I think that, it was absolutely a wonderful experience to go to each of these four places. Bodh Gaya, which is the place where the Buddha attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, which is in Bihar, India, and then going to Kushinagar, which is the place where the Buddha passed away, and then Sarnath, the place where the Buddha taught his first teaching, and then Tugumbini was where I wound up, where the Buddha was born. You know, all very wonderful symbolic places to go and contemplate these sort of steps and in the history of what the Buddha accomplished with his life. But I think for me one of the high points was Lumbini for sure. It was, you know, for one thing, sort of the end of the pilgrimage, I felt very satisfied. I felt like, wow, I've done it, I've made it. But it was also such a peaceful and beautiful place as well. Nepal is a wonderful place, so it was very moving.
What was it about Lumbini that really touched you, though?
I think it was there. I had kind of had some time to. I had gone through a Buddhist retreat. I had done some meditation. I had received some teachings at that point. It was a moment where I actually was able to sit by myself with some of that, armed with some of that knowledge and some of that, the tiny little bit of experience. And I did a meditation practice there on equanimity, where you imagine three people in front of you, a friend, an enemy, and a stranger, and you just kind of contemplate, you know, their qualities, and why is it that we label people in these ways? Why do we say, like, I like this person, I don't like this person I don't really care about? You know, why do we do that? And you kind of break them down and look at them a little more closely until you kind of come to this realization, an internal realization, an experiential realization that, wait a minute, my friend, my enemy, a stranger, me, we're all the same. We're all wanting the same things. We don't want suffering, and we want to be happy. And I think when I had this opportunity there then to kind of sit and rest and really contemplate that, and it really kind of struck home with me. And it was a great realization, you know, something I'm still working with and trying to integrate into my life on a daily basis, but it was quite profound there. So And the peace of the place was extraordinary.
And you had some physical hardships even going to some of these, you know, of these four places. You had also the din of India, the smells of India, the sights of India. All of this is overwhelmingly noted down and spoken about in your book, The Narrow Way. This cacophony of sights, sounds, smells, not knowing which train to get on at different times, getting the train and being on the train for 17 hours in order to arrive at your destination.
Right, exactly.
And then when you're going to go see His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you, after a 14-hour plane ride and a 17-hour train ride, you arrive there, and they say, "I'm sorry, there's no more tickets. You've gotten here an hour late," or something like that.
Exactly.
I mean, just, you know, amazing, amazing kind of things happening that really change you and move you. But in spite of it all, even going up the mountainside where the Sherpas are carrying your packs and everything, and your knees are screaming with every move that you make to go forward and upward, you know, you still decide that you are going to continue on. And no matter, you know, what happens, you are going through the narrow way. Chris Lemming, I want to thank you so much for being my guest, for writing this memoir, for being as honest as you are about who you are, and for bringing light into the world in the way that you're doing.
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's been a great pleasure being on your show. I've had a wonderful time talking with you. Thank you. You've been a wonderful host.
You're quite welcome. Be well.
Be well, too.
And my guest today from Planetary Spirit has been the author Chris Lemming, who is the author of his book, The Narrow Way, a memoir of coming out, getting clean, and finding Buddha. And the website for that book is www.thenarrowwaybook.com. That's TheNarrowWayBook.com. And coming up, my guest will be Randy Pizer, whose book is entitled Power of Miracle Thinking. So stay tuned for that. And also, I did not say who that was that I played during the break. And that was a song from the Spirit of Love CD, which is a compilation CD. And the vocals were by Scotty Haskell, written by Amanda McBroom, and the song was entitled The Rose. And so if you're enjoying this program and would like to access past interviews, go to www.planetary-spirit.com for on-demand archives of past shows, where recent interviews are now available on the Planetary Spirit website. And also, you can like us on the Facebook page while you're there. And so, this is Jeff Fiorinini, host of Planetary Spirit, wishing you all a blessed day.